The 3 hours that Chaplain Charlemagne has made available to me for discussions of aspects of the Army chaplaincy, I would like to divide up in this way. Today, I should like to talk about the Army chaplain per se. Secondly, on the next occasion that I meet with you, I should like to talk about the chaplain as counselor. This is an area in which a certain amount of adaptation is necessary as one compares the work of the civilian pastor as counselor and the military chaplain. And then on the third occasion of our coming together, I should like to talk to you on how to stay alive in the reserve. And this will be primarily, of course, of interest to the man who is in the Army Reserve, but it will have its implications also for those who belong to the reserves of the other two services. With Chaplain Charlemagne here, I can't refer to them properly as the two junior services. The Army chaplaincy differs from the Air Force chaplaincy and from the Naval chaplaincy, not merely in superficial details of the color of the clothing that you wear, but it also lies in the intrinsic difference of the missions that are given to the three major branches of the American Armed Services, both in terms of the actual utilization of the Army during wartime and also with reference to the mission of the Army within the Reserve and National Guard program. The Army operates ordinarily with moderately large units. The basic group to which a chaplain is assigned is a group which is known as a battalion. The actual size of a battalion will vary. It may be as small as somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 to 500 people. If it's a reinforced battalion, it may be as much as 2.5 or 3 times that size. Roughly, you can think in terms of a battalion at being about 900 to 1,000 men. By a rather complex formula, which gives to the military chaplaincy a certain percentage of the Army officer corps, the way in which chaplain assignments work out, you have roughly, in theory, one chaplain for about every 750 officers and enlisted personnel. This is, however, a somewhat more favorable ratio on paper than it is in actual practice. First of all, there may be occasions when you do not have your full complement of chaplains. Secondly, there are always a certain number of chaplains who are not available for chaplaincy service. A certain number of them are going to be going to school, primarily the chaplain school itself. Others of them are going to be on leave. A certain number of them will, I suppose, more or less inevitably be ill and for that reason unable to perform duty. And in some cases, this illness may extend over a considerable period of time. Some of them will, at any given time, be involved in actual transfers from one place to another. And while the Army moves its personnel wherever possible by air, where considerable distances are involved, nevertheless, the whole process of leaving one place, of going to another place, and of being assigned and actually being physically present and ready for duty may again involve a period ranging from days to weeks. The net result is that you have never the ideal arrangement of a chaplain for every 750 officers and enlisted men. And by way of a practical rule of thumb, again, the chaplain is going to be at about the ratio of 1 to 950 or 1,000. Again, the circumstances of assignment may make a difference for the army chaplain. It is quite obviously easier to take care of people in the United States, where most the members of the armed services and their dependents speak English and are in communities in which English is spoken, like Shakey's pizza parlor. In other cases, however, where you have them located, say in Vietnam or in Germany or in any one of the other places where military personnel are stationed, Korea, Japan, the Caribbean, you are quite likely to have a smaller number of people outside the military establishment able to come in and to take care of the needs which chaplains are not able to provide for. As a result, there is a tendency to cannibalize the domestic installations in order to provide an adequate measure of service overseas, where it is not possible quite so easily to draw in clergymen from the surrounding community. Now, with this idea, the chaplain as the head of the religious ministrations to a group of, on an average, about 900 to 1,000, we have the basic picture of the Army's operation. Now, of course, it's rare that you have a battalion sitting alone by itself. Usually the battalions are brigaded together in combat commands or similar headquarters that administer a number of battalions, either of the same kind or of different kinds. More and more, they are battalions of different kinds. That is to say, you will have infantry battalions, you will have artillery battalions, you will have battalions that are designed to facilitate attack under certain circumstances. You may have engineer battalions added, you may have armored organizations added, you may have smaller items reinforcing the battalion. You can think then in terms of normally a group of 10 to 15,000 people operating within the general framework of a division. And here you will have then a comparable number of chaplains, from 10 to 15 or so, if the procurement program has been working properly and if the assignment program has been working properly. It means then that you have, if you're dealing with 15 chaplains, a reasonable denominational spread. Ideally, you should have about 5 Roman Catholic chaplains. You should have one Lutheran chaplain in that group. You should have one Jewish chaplain, and the denominations that are roughly grouped together as Protestant will then constitute the balance. Usually you are quite likely to have an Episcopal chaplain in a group of that sort, although the average number of Episcopalians in the chaplaincy is not quite sufficient to ensure the assignment of one to every division. You will have, again, large numbers of chaplains gathered together at a training installation, such as the kind that you have here at Fort Leonard Wood. And again, the effort will be made to get a reasonably broad spread of denominational coverage in the chaplaincy in order to provide for the religious needs of the entire command, as far as this is possible. Well, this is, in general, the milieu within which the Army chaplain is going to work. He rarely is there by himself, whether in a training installation or abroad, or in an installation that is held in reserve in this country, such as some of the strategic striking forces that we maintain in the event of some kind of unforeseen attack upon American interests anywhere that would have to be met with an immediate opposition of force in being. The functions of the Army chaplain are not too different from the functions that would be assigned to a military chaplain in one of the other services, but the kind of installation in which he operates, the fact that it is usually a relatively large and ordinarily a land-based operation, means that he is going to have the carrying out of these functions modified to some extent. The basic instruction that the Army gives on chaplains is contained in this field manual, number 16-5, entitled The Chaplain. The manual prescribes, among the functions of the military chaplain, a recognition of the fact that the commander is responsible for the religious life, morals, and morale of the command. This picture is one which I am sure is familiar to you by now, that basically the commander is responsible for everything that goes on in his command. He is responsible for the dental health of his command. And if there are too many cases of trench mouth, it is the commander who is immediately held responsible. He is responsible for the mail delivery. And if the packages do not arrive in time, it is the commander who is going to be held responsible. He is held responsible for the state of his vehicles and of his transport, or of his helicopters and any other kind of transportation by air or by sea that may be attached to his organization. And he is responsible for the religious life, morals, and morale of the command. But just as little as the commanding officer actually sprays the mouths of the privates in order to combat trench mouth, and just as little as he gets up on a box and announces the names of recipients of packages, and just as little as he himself greases the jeeps and the trucks, so little is it the commanding officer who carries out this responsibility for the religious life, morals, and morale of the command. The chaplain, in a sense, therefore, is the alter ego of the commanding officer in this particular sphere of his activity, so that the chaplain, together with the other alter egos, I'm not going to try to make a Latin plural out of that, the chaplain with the other alter egos of the commander, the surgeon, the motor officer, the dental officer, the signal officer, the athletic and recreation officer, the troop information officer, the operations officer, the personnel officer, all of these activities and the remainder that the commanding officer is responsible for are shared among the staff. And in this staff now, the chaplain has this particular niche. Again, in the Army, because there are likely to be more than one chaplain in the command, even if you're in an area where you are in your actual operations, you are going to be quite widely dispersed, as happens in a considerable part of the operations in South Vietnam, the area where the chaplain is functioning is usually out of a base where there are a number of his kind. Now, it was an old classic principle, uk agatan poli koiran ye hais koiranas esto. It isn't good to have a multiplicity of lords, let there be one lord. The same thing applies, of course, with chaplains. As far as the military aspects are concerned, if you have several chaplains assigned to the same headquarters, the same brigade, the same combat command, the same group, one of them will be the staff chaplain and the other will be assistants. Now, this applies to the military aspects of the chaplain's activity. Sometimes it will happen that the commanding officer will say, I desire that all my chaplains have equal access to me. This is, frankly, not the best way to run a railroad, but it is the way in which some commanders, especially where they are confronted with the problem of denominational rivalries, that they say, well, the best way is to let each man have direct access to me. In general, you'll find, however, that the senior chaplain is the one who will act as the coordinator for the chaplain, and all of the chaplains together will then cooperate in carrying out their functions. Now, of course, because the chaplain is one of a group of staff officers, it doesn't mean that he is carrying everything to the commanding officer every time, or that he will get all of his direction and all of his instruction directly from the commanding officer. He is a part of a cooperative team The staff is, as it were, the extension of the commanding officer, and a great deal of his activity as a staff officer is going to be carried out in conjunction with the other members of the staff. This may be at a low level as well as at a high level. And a great many things that the chaplain is genuinely concerned about that involve one other staff officer may be something that will never get beyond the level of the two. This is a part of good staff procedure, that the issue is settled as far as possible among staff officers, and that possibly at most the matter then be brought up after the issue has been properly settled. Well, the chaplain, as the Army sees him, is primarily a clergyman in uniform. He represents religion. However, he represents religion probably in a less denominational way than the average clergyman represents religion in a civilian community. Because you cannot have representatives of every denomination in every headquarters in the Army, and because there are a considerable number of denominations that impose particular requirements upon the members of their respective denominations, the chaplain simply has to be able to work this out in some practical fashion, whereby if there is not, let us say, a disciples chaplain available, you are able to perform the necessary coordination. If there is not a Jewish chaplain available, you may be called upon not to be the Jewish chaplain or even a chaplain to the Jews, but that you are called upon to ensure that these men have precisely the same opportunity within the given possibilities of the situation that you would expect someone to accord to your Lutheran personnel if you were not physically present to take care of them. The chaplain is thought of as promoting religion and morality in the Army, a concept that just at the moment is causing some concern because of the position that has been taken by a series of Supreme Court decisions on the role of religion in the public institutions of our country. But the function of the chaplain to represent positively religion, and specifically and of course certainly to promote morality in the Army, to minister to the spiritual and moral needs of military personnel, their dependents, and of authorized civilians is the key responsibility that he possesses. In carrying out his mission, then, the chaplain, first of all, acts as advisor and consultant to the commander and his staff in all matters which pertain to religion, morals, and morale as affected by religion in the command. In other words, he does not have a comprehensive responsibility for morale, but he does have a responsibility for those aspects of morale which are affected by religion. And this is a very positive demand which is imposed upon the chaplain. His commanding officer is not a religious expert, and he needs to be counseled about the consequences and the implications of the policies that are recommended to him and that ultimately he must decide upon, in terms of their impact upon the religious life of the command and in terms of the impact of his decisions upon the civilian community. If, for instance, to step outside the immediate situation of the Army, the case of Commander Arnheiter, who was relieved of command in the Navy. It was reported in large part because of chaplain objections, because of the kind of meeting that he had on his ship, which for many of the individuals concerned was not too easily differentiated from a Protestant religious service, and may very well have partaken of some of the aspects of a certain type of Protestant religious service. This was felt to be inimical. Now, a chaplain, a commanding officer, who, for instance, would, with the best of intentions, order his men to attend a specific religious service or series of religious services, would need to be warned by the chaplain that this particular course of action is bound to involve that commanding officer in some aspect of trouble that may reflect adversely upon the performance of the mission of his unit and upon himself personally. Again, in the commander's zeal, let us say, to reduce the venereal disease rate that he may be observing in his organization, he may propose some procedures, or it may be even that the medical officer of the command will propose procedures which are offensive to the feelings of individuals in the command on the basis of their own religious sensibilities. It is the command, it is the chaplain's responsibility in a case of that sort to grind this fact into the computer of the commanding officer's decisions. Or if the commanding officer proposes to undertake a particular type of training, and this happens to land on a day when the Roman Catholic Church specifies that it is a holy day of obligation, or if it turns out to be a day where the considerable Jewish component of that command is in a situation where they need to be participating in religious services, the chaplain will have failed in his duty if he has not called that to the commander's attention, so that the commander can take appropriate cognizance of these things and make such provision as the circumstances call for. The chaplain, as I've said, does this not only for the commander, but he does it for all of the other staff officers, and this implies then a very intimate and close cooperation on the part of the chaplain that is not met merely if the chaplain is present at staff meetings, but it means that he spends consciously a considerable amount of his effort on maintaining the friendliest and most helpful kind of relationships with the other officers who represent the commander. The army requires of its chaplains that they provide opportunities for worship, public and private, consistent with the religious beliefs, customs, and practices of the military personnel, their dependents, and authorized civilians. Now, there is something of a paradox here. On the one hand, the chaplain must provide religious services of his own. This is a statutory requirement. It goes back to a time when the pluralism of American religion was not quite as party-colored as it is at the present time, and when what Hudson has called the great tradition of the churches was a more consistent thing than it is now, when you really had to consider only a Reformed and a Roman Catholic tradition. Still, no matter what the man's denomination is, whether he is Seventh-day Adventist, or whether he is Jewish, or Unitarian, or Lutheran, or Roman Catholic, or Eastern Orthodox, or Latter-day Saints, he has the obligation to conduct religious services for the command. Now, these services are, of course, conducted in accordance with his own conscientious conviction. He is not expected to be omnicompetent so that he can pull the People's Mass book out of one pocket and say Mass for the Roman Catholics and pull the Siddur out of the other pocket and conduct a service for the Jewish personnel. But quite obviously, these statutory services will be conducted in such a way that they, within the competence of the individual chaplain's conscientious practice and his understanding of what his ministry and mission are, it will be designed to meet the needs as broadly as possible of as many people in the command as he can. However, he is called upon not only to conduct services, but he is to provide opportunities for worship. And for this, he is expected to draw upon the facilities offered within the military establishment by other chaplains, first of all. If, for instance, therefore, you happen to be over in a particular organization of a training camp, and a unit is going out on a weekend bivouac, and there are a sufficient number of Lutherans in that command to make it worthwhile, make it desirable, actually, to conduct Lutheran services, you will be expected to make some provision for this. In the same way, if you happen to be the chaplain of that organization, you would ensure that as far as possible, some provision is made for the needs of the personnel of denominations other than your own, as far as this can be done within a reasonable exertion of effort. I have known of cases where, for instance, from Fort Knox, Kentucky, command felt that a single Seventh-day Adventist was worth taking during the period of his training to the nearest city where there was a Seventh-day Adventist congregation and brought back every week. This may be a little bit on the extremely accommodating side, but it illustrates the way in which the Army understands its responsibility, the maximum degree of feasibility in the premises. Public and private, and again, the criterion is the religious beliefs, customs, and practices of the people. In other words, it's not the chaplain who decides what religious services are needed. He can't tell a Lutheran, well, you ought to be satisfied with the Episcopal service that we're conducting here. Or he can't tell the Roman Catholic, well, you ought to be satisfied with an Eastern Orthodox service, or vice versa. The criterion is always the religious needs of the people concerned, that is, the religious needs as they are defined for the members of those churches by the churches themselves. It is also his responsibility to provide for the proper and appropriate administration of rites, sacraments, and ordinances. Again, no chaplain can be required to, say, celebrate Holy Communion and to admit anyone whom he could not conscientiously admit. He cannot be called upon to absolve anybody and hear his confession. He cannot be called upon to marry anybody. I remember a situation that developed at Fort Snelling, Minnesota, where the Army does some strange things. It's paralleled only by two other services in the United States military establishment. But here, for some quaint reason or other, at the Fort Snelling Reception Center, where you had all of the Lutherans of Minnesota and the Dakotas and Western Wisconsin pouring in, it was probably the one organization outside of the Norwegian battalion that had as many Lutherans per square inch. So obviously they put in a Roman Catholic and a Southern Baptist. This was the occasion for a considerable sense of annoyance on the part of the Lutherans, and a former Lutheran chaplain there at the time of his relief had entered a strong recommendation that he be replaced by another Lutheran. The Armed Services Commission of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod put in a strong request that a Lutheran be assigned. The Lutheran, the Bureau of Service to Military Personnel of the National Lutheran Council put in an equally strong representation, and the Army responded, you've got to hand it to them. Pretty soon, there were three Lutheran chaplains and one Roman Catholic chaplain at Fort Snelling. I think that probably, if you were to go over the roster of the Fort Snelling chaplain activities, you would find that fewer marriages were solemnized during this period than at any other time in the history of the chapel. For the simple reason, of course, that the Roman Catholic and the three Lutherans all had relatively rigorous standards as far as the solemnization of holy matrimony was concerned. And therefore, when you had individuals who had no particular religious affiliation, and one or both of whom were divorced one or more times, the Lutheran and the Roman Catholic chaplains simply had to say, well, I'm sorry, we are not able under the canons of our respective churches to provide the service in which you're interested. And so what they had to do, however, as a matter of conscience and as a matter of regulations and obligation, was to ensure that there were some accommodating Methodist and Baptist and Presbyterian clergy in the neighborhood to whom they could refer these aspirants to the Order of Benedict, and in the event that it wasn't possible to refer them to one of these, we kept a list of the justices of the peace who were able to tie at least legally valid and secularly acceptable knots. But no one could have required any one of us, and happily no one did, to engage in a marriage ceremony that contradicted our convictions. In the same way, your commanding officer cannot tell you what you are to preach. He cannot tell you how you are to organize your order of service. All of this lies within your province. Now, of course, there's a certain risk in it, and you have to do it well. If you, by nonfeasance or malfeasance, in the same way, your commanding officer cannot tell you what you are to preach. He cannot tell you how you are to organize your order of service. all of this lies within your province. Now, of course, there's a certain risk in it, and you have to do it well. If you, by nonfeasance or malfeasance, alienate a large proportion of the command because of the way in which you conduct your services or the way you preach. I recall at Fort Leavenworth, we had one individual who really preached himself out of the army. His sermons ran 45 minutes in a chapel where the tradition was not over 19. And it was a strange thing. Not only did he fail of promotion to captain, his papers always landed in the wrong office and lay there for a day or two before they were forwarded somewhere else. But it was also discovered that an old football injury to his back threatened to become active again. And he presently found himself an ex-chaplain. I mean, there are hazards involved. And sometimes these are occupational hazards of a real sort. I know of relatively few good chaplains who don't have somewhere in their record a wound stripe, where, because of their conscientious administration of their office, they ran afoul of a commanding general or a commanding officer, and this showed on their record. Might be that they ran afoul of the commanding officer's wife. This is also a possibility. But again, these are the occupational hazards. These are the things that we take in stride. But again, we are responsible for ensuring that, regardless of how we feel about a Mormon communion service, or how we feel about a bar mitzvah, or as they have them even now in some advanced Jewish communities, some bat mitzvah services. However we may feel about any of this, as to its intrinsic spiritual validity, we have the obligation to provide for the proper and appropriate administration of rites, sacraments, and or ordinances. It is likewise his responsibility to provide religious education and instruction, consonant with the desires of the individual concerned. A Lutheran chaplain will almost constantly be having one or more instruction classes going on. This is a routine part of his work. And it's an interesting thing that statistically our chaplains report more adult confirmations than the average of our civilian clergy, because the opportunities that are open to the chaplain in the military service are considerably more fruitful than those that are open to the average civilian. But this is, of course, only one part of it. He will have responsibilities for the whole religious education program. It's conceivable that he may, in one situation or another, be specifically the chaplain who has this responsibility. If this is the case, he will again, of course, have to try to administer a program that is broad and inclusive enough to meet the needs of all of the command. Here again, he is expected, as far as this is feasible, to use what is known as the unified curriculum. This is a broad gauge series of materials, or as has been discussed in a previous conference, a broad gauge series of materials that are selected by both military and civilian representatives of various denominations. Initially, it started out as a kind of log-rolling experiment on the part of the church-related publishers, but as time has gone on, especially in the face of objections that have been voiced here and there because of the quality of certain of the materials provided, the unified curriculum has turned out to be a reasonably effective instrument. Now, here I would stress again, nobody is compelled to use it, but it has certain virtues, and if you are called upon to organize and to conduct a program of this kind, of course, you have a marvelous opportunity, if only because it gives you a good excuse for training the Sunday school teachers, many of whom will have been completely untrained, and it gives you thereby a chance, at least vicariously, to communicate solid religious training. Again, the chaplain is expected to provide character guidance instruction. Character guidance program, which Chaplain Charlemagne has discussed with you, and which is to a very large extent of his own devising, one of the great contributions that he and through him our church has made to the United States Armed Services. In the case of the Army chaplain, this is now operated on a one lecture a month program. The chaplain is the coordinator of the program. He isn't called upon to deliver all the lectures. He can draw in anyone whom he chooses and who is competent, and he will, if he is wise, utilize both officers and enlisted personnel for this, but he is still ultimately the individual who is responsible for coordinating it. He receives admirable help in the way of materials, and here again, he has, while this is not a specifically spiritual activity of his, it provides him with an opportunity for making constructive contact. The chaplain is also expected to provide pastoral care, including counseling, spiritual guidance. We'll talk about counseling specifically, as I've indicated, in another lecture. But he is also called upon to visit the sick and, with the delicate military language, the incarcerated. Those who are in confinement facilities. And make pastoral visits to barracks, quarters, training, and recreational areas. The standard that has been established by the Chief of Chaplains of the Army is that the active duty chaplain is expected to spend a minimum of 50% of his duty hours with troops. That is to say, he is not to sit in his office like a giant spider waiting for an enlisted fly to flutter in, but he is to be out making the contacts and taking the initiative. And particularly, he has this responsibility over against the sick and over against the individuals who have run afoul of military law. He is called upon to cooperate with religious groups and welfare agencies in civilian communities, and he had jolly well better inform himself as he goes from place to place. He is required to provide a program of cultural and social activities consistent with the religious needs of the command. He is not the athletic and recreation officer, although he may work with him. And he is, this is put as the last point, but it is, from the Army's point of view, a fundamental one. So fundamental that it might very well be put at the very beginning. He satisfies religious obligations established by ecclesiastical authorities to ensure maintenance of denominational endorsement. Because if the chaplain cannot maintain his denominational endorsement, he cannot, by law, be a chaplain. And the moment that that denominational endorsement is withdrawn, with the present advanced state of electronic communications, the life as a chaplain of a chaplain whose denominational endorsement is withdrawn is less than 48 hours. It is his responsibility to keep in the good graces of his denomination. If he fails to do this, he is of no use to the Army, and the Army cooperates fully with religious denominations in the elimination of chaplains whose ecclesiastical endorsement they withdraw. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean that the chaplain will do only that which is necessary to keep the axe from coming down squarely on his head. But it means that he is going to maintain, through attendance at pastoral conferences, through the regular reports that he will cheerfully make to the Armed Forces Commission. I would underline that. I have found that the Armed Forces Commission is an agency that has done so much for chaplains that I have always regarded my contacts, even if it was in the nature of a report, as something to be cheerfully undertaken. But it also means that he will maintain, as far as he possibly can, where he's stationed in the vicinity of a church of our communion, that he will maintain cordial personal relationships with that entire community. This, in brief, is the way in which the Army, specifically, thinks of the obligations of the military chaplain. Are not materially different, as I, in overall description, from that of other services, but the Army has its, because of its particular mission and its particular constitution, its own ways of applying these functions and implementing. Now, we have a few minutes for questions, which you may have. Yes.
As I understand it, then a Lutheran chaplain is not obligated to have communion service for
That's right.
Then it is his responsibility to bring in a Protestant for a service.
Mm-hmm.
In Babel,
yeah.
Once a month or something.
Right. I think you will find now the liturgical the worship revival in the Protestant churches has inculcated into some Protestants an awareness of the importance of the Lord's Supper, as they are inclined to call it. As a result, you may find an increasing interest in some areas. But in general, you will still find that the sacraments do not play, or the ordinances do not play the role in other denominations that they do in ours. And for this reason, it will be your obligation in the command to which you are assigned to try to assay the situation. But certainly a minimum of a quarterly opportunity should be provided. And now whether you're going to do this on a monthly basis, some denominations, such as the Churches of Christ, expect a weekly observance of the Lord's Supper. And here you might have to make provisions that these men can get in, or that a Christian clergyman is brought out if the number is large enough to warrant this kind of thing. But it works out quite simply, and almost, as I've said, you are not likely to be the only chaplain in the command, and it's again relatively unlikely that you will be the only non-Roman Catholic chaplain. And if there is another non-Roman Catholic chaplain, of course, this is the logical thing that to utilize him. If you happen to be in a separate battalion or something of this kind, well then the device that you've suggested is the very best way of doing it.